Welcome to Behind the Headlines, a weekly news roundup of stories from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the show we are talking about the inquiry that is underway at BYU over whether a basketball player there received gifts from a school athletics booster, a look at a syringe exchange program in Salt Lake City that aims to help intravenous drug users, the move by KBYU Television and Radio to change its format, which has resulted in petitions by fans of the station's classical music programming, and Utah support for the declaration of an opioid national health emergency. All of that and more on the docket today. Joining me to discuss these stories, Salt Lake Tribune Sports Enterprise reporter Aaron Falk. Welcome, Aaron. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Social justice reporter Christopher Smart. Great to have you here, Chris.
Good morning.
Television critic Scott Pierce is with us as well. Thanks for joining us, Scott.
Thank you.
And editorial writer George Pyle. Thanks for being here, George.
Good morning.
And you can join us for this conversation as well. Post your questions and comments at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page, or you can call us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And we're going to start today with some news from the world of college athletics, which I think listeners will know is a bit unusual for this show. But Aaron Falk, you broke the story last night that the NCAA and Brigham Young University are investigating whether a BYU basketball player received gifts from a school booster. I think it's gifts from a school booster, something that is a violation of NCAA regulations. Aaron, I guess just what's the story here? What happened?
Yeah, so as far as we know at this point, the NCAA and BYU are looking into allegations involving Nick Emery, who is a junior starter on the basketball team. He was a state champion in Utah from Lone Peak High School, one of the Tribune's high school MVP that year as well. Mm-hmm. And what we know is that they've been presented with allegations, and we know at least a couple of them, which include, possibly improper use of a vehicle and some travel. That's what's being alleged, and that's currently what BYU and the NCAA are looking at right now, trying to figure out.
You mentioned Nick Emery. He's the student in question, and kind of I don't know. Is he a star for the team? A central player for BYU?
Yeah, he's a starter for sure. Definitely one of their better players, and certainly someone who was looking to have a big year for them. And he's still on the team. He played in their scrimmage on Wednesday night. I don't know what, if anything, will change with his status going forward. But yeah, he's definitely an impact player for them.
And then to this to the BYU booster. A booster is someone who financially supports athletics programs at a given school, we should say. In this instance, Brandon Tindall is the name of the guy. He's a member of the school's Cougar Club. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah, he's a member of the Cougar Club. And even if he weren't, completely associated with an official club, there are the definition is a lot more broad than that. Anyone who's a season ticket holder or provides those sorts of benefits to athletes could qualify for that. But there's also, maybe an out, depending on the length of their relationship. If there was a pre-existing, relationship that predates, his time in college athletics, which is something that no one wanted to really get into. We reached out to Nick Emery's family and to Brandon Tindall and other people, and it's sort of, we got hushed at that point.
Trying to figure out exactly how long they've been friends.
Precisely.
What are the things that are, what are the actual benefits that Tindall is alleged to have given Emery? I mean, how or not alleged, but, what seems to be there, I guess?
Yeah, what BYU is looking at, what's in question is some travel, a few trips, things that popped up on, social media posts have since been deleted. And then this Jetta, which we've confirmed was in Brandon Tindall's name at one point, and then was transferred to Emery's family's name, which would also be a violation, unless there's some documentation or what have you of that sort of pre-existing relationship.
And the Jetta is the car that was given, I guess.
Correct.
Or maybe given or transferred to kind of yet to be determined. A quick reminder to our listeners that you can join us with your questions and comments. The number to call, 801-355-8255, or you can comment at sltrib.com. Aaron, you point out that both BYU and the NCAA are looking at this. You reported that BYU kind of got a tip that something might be going on, and that's why they launched their own inquiry into this. Is that right?
Correct. And you know, it's not uncommon for schools to self-report. But to me, that indicates certainly that the they took it serious enough that whatever allegations in total they received were serious enough for them to notify the NCAA and to hire outside counsel, a law firm that deals with you know, possible NCAA infractions. That's their specialty.
Mm-hmm. Is the reason that gifts like these are forbidden from the NCAA's, you know, standpoint is because it's seen as, you know, potential bribes to entice a student to play at one school versus another school? Is that's
certainly part of it. I mean, you know, the NCAA is theoretically amateur athletics, and it's sort of interesting at this point. I mean, one, there's obviously a big news nationally with this federal investigation into some recruiting violations at schools across the country. They're asking every college basketball program, Division I college basketball program, to conduct internal reviews, which is happening in the state. But I think the attitude and culture has sort of changed, that people are more willing or interested in seeing athletes compensated for college athletes compensated for their time that they feel schools profit off of them without sharing in that revenue. And that's an ongoing debate and something that, you know, I mean, I'm not unsympathetic to.
Right. I mean, at some point down the line, giving out these kinds of gifts might not be. I mean, what you're describing is a situation in which athletes are maybe getting paid even by schools or school boosters.
Certainly there are people that would like to see that.
OK. The basketball season is getting close to starting. What are the potential penalties or, you know, punishments if the NCAA decides that something improper has been going on here?
Yeah, I mean, if they determine things are happening in the season and somehow, you know, he's an ineligible player, there's the potential to forfeit games. And like I said, I'm not sure what, if anything, will happen, change with Emery's status, if he'll, you know, sit redshirt, what have you. I have no clue how they'll handle this. Those are questions that we're still trying to figure out as we continue our reporting here.
Okay. I'm going to bring an editorial voice in on this as well. George Pyle, we're talking about college athletics. We take it very seriously. Big news breaking from last night about this potential, almost I want to call it bribery, but it's a gift scandal. I don't know how you would call it. What do you think about this, George?
Well, it is another example of how there is so much money in college athletics, and there's so much on the line, and there's so much pressure for programs and coaches to get to the higher level and excel, and in the case of basketball, make the postseason, make the NCAA tournament. You know, they call it March Madness for a reason, and the temptation to cheat, to recruit, to entice. With things that, you know, in other colleges that are a lot worse than here, you can drive my car, is rampant. And I guess it almost comes down to your view of human nature. Is it really realistic to expect, with this much on the line, with this much pressure for a coach in a program to excel, to expect that this kind of stuff and much more doesn't go on all the time, won't go on all the time? It just kind of, to me, is kind of a strange look at human nature. The question comes down to, do we give up? Do we say, these aren't amateurs, these are professionals? And like other college students who get paid for working in the library or mowing the lawn or get internships, paid or unpaid, in their chosen career, why should this be different? Why shouldn't they share in all the money that's being made? Then you say, well, then you lose your amateur standing, and it's not for the fun of the game anymore. Well, kind of seems like that ship sailed a long time ago.
Well, there's big, I mean, as you're pointing out, and Aaron points out, that there's big money involved, and it almost, you know, the pressure for a program, for example, Aaron, say a not just the coach, but the recruiters and everybody to try and get the best players has got to be playing into this as well. When you have contracts with television stations, you've got money coming in for the program. If the school is successful, they're going to fundraise more. Kind of self-duplicating process, I guess.
Yeah, and I would say, I would add that the other thing to consider is, given the broad definition of boosters and sort of the oversight, I mean, it's a, it would be a difficult task to have complete oversight over an entire you know, fan base to make sure that these things aren't, these improprieties aren't taking place. And so I know, you know, even in, you know, the strictest programs where coaches would, you know, try to control every aspect of their program, they'll run into things where boosters will have overstepped a line and they, you know, they have to try to beat back their own supporters from, you know, stop not being overzealous in these sorts of pursuits.
And whether or not the school is aware of it or whether or not the coach is aware of it, if it's happening, it's still a violation, right? I mean, the ignorance is not an excuse here.
Correct. And then the NCAA would determine, I guess, how aware and you know, what the appropriate punishment is. And the NCAA moves at a glacial pace with these sorts of things. I mean, we saw North Carolina's academic fraud investigation wrap up, and I think that was four or five years. I mean, it did not happen quickly.
In the making. It kind of reminds me, all of this kind of reminds me a little bit of the Olympic bid scandals, you know, with the bribery to try and secure games for one city or another because of the big money involved. But just in terms of how long that... you know, that inquiry is going to go on, and you talk about the glacial pace at which the NCAA moves. For this BYU case, is it going to happen quicker than that four-year period?
I think everyone around the process would hope so. I mean, to get peace of mind, whether you're Nick Emery and you're completely absolved of this, or if you're the basketball program, to know, hey, we've got to handle this player, you know, in such a way. I mean, I'm sure everyone would like to have this resolved quickly. Like I said, it doesn't seem to happen that quickly, but...
And just, I don't know if we ever got this out there, but both... you weren't able to get a comment from Emery or his family, but you did speak to Tyndall, and he's the booster in question. He says... He has a statement about this. He says that nothing happened that was against the rules.
Correct, and he believes that Emery will be cleared, and That may very well be. I'll go back to just BYU confirming this and self-reporting this to show, in my estimation, that they at least thought they had something serious enough that it was worth looking into.
Okay. Aaron Falk, great coverage, and thank you for bringing us this story. Again, the news was that BYU and the NCAA are looking into whether a basketball player was receiving gifts from a school booster, something that would go against college athletics guidelines. You can find the full story in your morning paper or at sltrib.com. And we'll be moving on to other headlines from this past week's news after a short break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We will be back in a minute.
It's Halloween, a time of spirit and flesh, magic and mayhem, tricks and treats. We hear about Lugaroo, werewolves in Louisiana, and the devil in daily life of Mississippi blues. Also, seasonal sounds from Howlin' Wolf, Dr. John, Memphis Minnie, and Johnny Cash. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Join us tomorrow night at 8 on Utah Public Radio.
This week in This American Life. Okay, the Earth is round, right? It revolves around the sun, and the sun rises in the east, sets in the west. We all know this with certainty, confidence. But why? Like, how do we know this? There's a place in the Arctic where a group firmly believes that the sun is now rising in the wrong spot.
And we were kind of looking at each other just going, whoa, what does that mean?
It's this week.
Join us tomorrow morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune social justice reporter Christopher Smart, TV critic Scott Pierce, and editorial writer George Pyle. This is our Friday local news wrap-up. You can join us with your questions and comments at sltrib.com or call us up at 801-355-8255. And since we were talking about Cougar basketball before the break, let's stay in Provo a little bit longer. TV critic Scott Pierce, a story that you covered this week had to do with the changes that are afoot for a local public television and public radio provider. This is KBYU, Channel 11 on TV, 89.1 on radio. What are the changes in store, Scott?
Well, BYU Broadcasting has basically been offering five different things. They've had BYU TV on cable, BYU Radio on Sirius and online. They had BYU International, which was Spanish and some Portuguese, I think, programming in various countries and some places here. And then in Utah, we've had Channel 11 since, I think, 1960, and we've had KBYU-FM. And they're going from 5 to 2. They're eliminating the international, although they say they're going to continue to produce some foreign language programming. They're making Channel 11 a broadcast outlet for BYU-TV, and they're making KBYU-FM a local broadcast outlet for BYU Radio, which is a bunch of different shows. It's like talk shows and, you know, shows about, yes, there are shows about faith, but it's, you know, a lot of sports and stuff.
Right. This is the question I wanted to get to, was is it drastically different than the public radio format that they've been
yes.
going through, which is classical music?
Which has been all classical music all the time. Hmm. And they've decided that their mission points them to do these two things, and this is what makes sense. And, of course, there are classical music fans
who are
under the impression that there's no other way to get classical music, who are having a heart attack about this. And I'm being a little facetious there, but, you know, it's people hate change, any change. And so you could predict that there was going to be some outrage here.
Well, Scott, on the, you know, on when it comes to terrestrial radio stations that broadcast using radio equipment like ours here at KCPW, as opposed to satellite receivers or streaming online, does this mean that for those kinds of stations, at least, there won't be classical music on in our market anymore?
Yes. I mean, well, yes and no. I mean, it's the last regular FM station. KUER has a, you know, a secondary. If you have HD radio, or you can go online, because KUER 3, I think, maybe it's 2, is classical music. I mean, so, yeah. And frankly, this is basically what's happening every place. I mean, there are far fewer classical music radio stations than there were 10 years ago, certainly 20 or 30 years ago. Hmm.
Well, I'll say that, like you, I read in your article that 89.1 was one of the presets in your car. I have that as well.
Yeah.
And along with this station, KUER, KRCL, I'm a public radio person. But that there won't be classical music anymore on that button is just a change. I'm one of those people who's worried about the change.
I mean, it's certainly less convenient. And again, I don't mean to sound as if I'm anti-classical music, because I'm not. I do listen to it. I don't listen to it in the car all the time, but right. I do sometimes. And it's been very convenient because my car is 7 years old, so I don't have HD radio. But I mean, when you sit and think about it, certainly the Channel 11 thing has always been a little crazy because, because it's BYU, they don't offer all PBS programming. You know, they're not going to do the controversial documentaries and things like that. But every PBS show that's on Channel 11 is also on Channel 7.
Okay.
I looked at one, you know, the day that they announced this, I looked at the schedule, and it was like 16 of their 24 hours was stuff that was also available on KUED. So that mm-hmm. makes sense. And honestly, I mean, I'm not making a statement one way or the other about what their mission is,
right.
But a 24-hour classical music station doesn't really seem to fit with BYU's mission. I mean, that's going to upset people. It obviously has already upset people, you know.
But right, it's their prerogative to do what they're going to do. I'm going to turn to George Pyle for just a moment here. Scott Pierce wrote a column saying that that for the TV station and for the radio station, this was essentially the right thing to do because the same content was being duplicated, at least on the TV station side, on KUED. What say you?
Well, I mean, television it was pretty duplicative, and so you understand why they want to say, well, let's not do what they're doing. Let's do what we're good at. Let's do our specialty, which is to promote BYU and to promote the LDS Church and carry out their mission. It's their license. It's their station. They do what they want. And because of the duplication, I don't think we're going to miss very much, especially because we all get this on cable. I mean, if we were all still up on the roof with our antenna and our tinfoil on our rabbit ears or something, then you might be depriving somebody of something. But that's not the way it works anymore. On the radio side, I'm going to miss classical music on regular radio in the car. I listen to at home and at the Tribune, I listen to the Channel 3 on the university radio station. It's classical music all the time, no commercials, it's great, but, you know, not being able to just sit in the car, punch that, and have my son tell me to quit listening to that stuff is I'll miss that a little bit.
Sure.
But probably maybe the next car I get may have the extra radio channel, and I'll still be able to listen to it.
And my big question on Channel 11 is, what's going to happen to Lawrence Welk?
No more Lawrence Welk.
Oh.
Well, that's, and honestly, I mean, it was kind of a joke, but it actually wasn't a joke. I've heard from more people who were unhappy that they weren't going to be, you know, that they were, there weren't going to be Perry Mason reruns on at 10:30 at night than I have from anyone who's concerned about watching Sesame Street or, you know, American Experience or something.
Well, there's another one of those channels way up the dial that has Perry Mason.
Yeah, oh yeah, there is. And that, yeah, that's one of Channel 4's alternates.
And I don't know about here, but I know other markets where I've watched public TV and been on public TV. Pledge Drive, they roll out the Lawrence Welk, and boy, that brings it in.
go ahead, Scott.
The other thing I was going to say is just that when the radio station and the TV station came into being, I mean, it was a long time ago, not just in terms of broadcasting, but in terms of the church. Hmm. The church was very Utah-centered, and it's not so much anymore. And the idea that the church-owned university is having another PBS station in classical music just for listeners and viewers here in Utah, you know, it seems sort of antiquated at this point.
This might seem like kind of an odd question, but is it possible that, you know, KBYU TV viewers, people who, you know, grew up watching it, who were sort of loyal to the station and out of loyalty or even out of enmity might not turn to KUED to watch the programs that they, you know, that they would otherwise watch on?
I mean, I suppose it's possible. It's not certainly, you know, KUED didn't have anything to do with this.
Right.
And if I had a little kid who wanted to watch Sesame Street, it's a lot cheaper to watch it on KUED than to subscribe to HBO, you know. So it's I could see some of that. And there are people who are saying, you know, that they'll never donate any money again. I don't know that KUED is going to see a huge uptick, but I bet they get more viewers and at least to some degree more pledges out of this.
This is happening in the context of kind of wider broadcast changes in our valley. And I want to just detour for a second into this, Scott. Something that you've reported on is the consolidation of media. Sinclair Broadcasting has control of a number of TV stations here in our market. Is that right, Scott?
They own KUTV. They've owned KMYU for several years, and they bought KJAZ in the last few months.
And then part of that is a little bit in flux, depending upon what happens at the national level.
Sinclair is buying Tribune, which is not our Tribune. It's the group that was once associated with the Chicago Tribune, but they've, you know, the companies have split.
Right.
I say they're buying it. It has to be approved, the FCC. I would assume that the FCC is going to approve it. However, Sinclair owns the three stations here already. Tribune owns KSTU Channel 13, Fox 13.
Mm-hmm.
If this was a year ago, I would say to you, well, the rule is you can't own two stations that are among the top four billing in a market. And given that KUTV and KSTU are number one and number two, they're going to have to sell one or the other, presumably Channel 13. I don't know what's going to happen now. I mean, they've been deregulating. If Mr. Huntsman would like to buy a television station, he can do it now because the FCC has just changed the rules to allow for ownership of a newspaper and a television station in the same market, which, yes, we have KSL in the Deseret News, but that was grandfathered in when this rule came along in 75, I think. But now that's out the window. They've changed the rules in terms of and the interpretations in terms of how much of the country you can cover so that companies can get bigger and bigger. I mean, if I had to guess, I would still say that they'll have to divest of Channel 13, but I'm not as sure as I once was.
Well, and the tie-in between the two stories that we've been talking about here, consolidation would seem to limit our access to different perspectives. And maybe I'm forcing a connection, actually, Scott. But what does the loss of another public television option, just in the terms of you know, channels, number of channels available for alternative viewpoints, what does that do?
Well, I mean, I've written. I mean, I think more voices are better. Unless everyone wants to go away and everyone has to read the Tribune, I'm good with that. But, you know, I believe that more voices are better. And if 13 and 2 belong to the same company, then Sinclair has got another voice and you've lost one. You know, that's not, I don't think that's a good thing. And that was what FCC was supposed to not allow that sort of thing to happen.
Well, and Chris Martin. There's this sort of other thing wafting about, and that is Sinclair, the owners of Sinclair, are very conservative folks. And they have been known to guide the news.
Yeah, and that's, you know, there are stations and there might be some locally who run, you know, the company sends out must run.
Right, they're required
segments.
To run content.
And there are some stations that air those and times when not much of anybody's watching the news.
Almost as a sort of protest.
Well, or just, you know, because they figure that it's not good for them.
Hmm. Okay.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, if Sinclair succeeds in buying Tribune, one of the things Tribune owns is WGN America, which is a cable station or cable, you know, outlet that not much of anybody watches. But there's been talk that they may turn it into a competitor to Fox News.
Mm. You know. Interesting to see. George Pyle, we haven't heard from you on this part of this conversation yet, consolidation of media. What do you think?
Well, it's bad. We do want to have more voices. I mean, this does, though, recall when the Tribune was owned, the Salt Lake Tribune was owned along with all these other papers by Alden Global Capital and, you know, the horrible, evil hedge fund out of New York City.
I always refer to them as the horrible evil hedge fund.
One thing that was good about that in terms of editorial content, news content, opinion page content, they didn't care. They really, really, really didn't care.
Because they were removed.
They were removed, and they weren't in the propaganda business. They were just looking to make money.
George, I can't let this go by without asking. Are you worried that that's gone away? People not caring, your owners not caring about the editorial content?
No, I'm glad they care, and I'm glad they're local, and I'm glad they care about the Tribune as an institution. But Sinclair, they tell their stations what to say to a large degree. There are other chain owners of newspapers and TV stations that don't.
Right.
And so it can be hard to make rules where you differentiate between the corporations that dictate content and the corporations that don't.
And there are very few locally owned editorial voices here. You know, there's the Tribune and there are the church properties and that's it.
Right.
You know, I mean, and I'm not, as George says, there's a difference. Some stations or some owners have more influence as to what the editorial voice is than others. But, you know, Channel 4, Channel 13, Channel 30, none of these are locally owned.
Right, right. A small number that are actually locally owned. Well, guys, we've got to get to other stories from this past week's news. But Scott Pierce, thanks very much for your reporting on this. Thank you for your patience on the stories that you've covered this week. And I want to turn to what you have been covering. And in a piece that you wrote this week, you featured a syringe exchange program here in Salt Lake City and the impact that program is having. Christopher Smart, I think I'll just let you talk about this program. Who runs it? How did it get started? How does it work? And who is it helping?
Well, there are actually several around. The one we looked at most recently was called One Voice Recovery. It was founded by a fellow who was once an intravenous drug user and recognizing the fact that drug addicts are going to use drugs and they are going to use needles whether or not they are clean. And the spread of hepatitis C, HIV, and other diseases is common with drug users, particularly when they use dirty needles.
Mm-hmm.
There's the data is there. It's pretty cut and dried. If these addicts use clean needles, they're going to be healthier. And in this case, Patrick Rizek, who founded this program, believes that if you stay in contact with these folks, keep a dialogue going with them, keep showing them that there are alternatives to their lifestyle, that you know, eventually they will want to change and go into treatment.
The syringe exchange being a kind of entree into having those conversations that they might not, that they wouldn't otherwise be able
to. Yeah, that's correct. And so before Operation Rio Grande, there was a syringe exchange program down on 500 West. That one was operated by the Utah Harm Reduction Coalition, and they just set up a tent twice a week, and folks would line up to get not only syringes, but they had these little packs that contained things that made it easier, you know, like alcohol swabs, something to tie your arm off so the the vein would pop and all that sort of thing. And
you said was. This did exist. It doesn't exist anymore.
No, because Operation Rio Grande basically wiped that out. They don't go there anymore. That operation is still going on, but it really just sent them hither and yon because the population went hither and yon.
Right.
There's very few. If you go down there, it's like night and day as before. Now, before, it was really bad. So everybody agrees that something had to be done. But now these addicts are scattered all over the county.
Yeah.
And so this program actually goes and seeks them out. They seek them out along the river. They also do house calls to people's apartments.
Yeah. And you went out, I mean, you went out with Reza as he did this exchange. And where did you go? You went with him to, I think it was along the banks of the Jordan River.
Yeah, well, we went several places, actually. We went to, you know, West Side warehouse lots and all kinds of places that people normally don't go. But we did go down to the Jordan River and hiked along the river there. And people camp sort of in these locations that are hard to see. You know, they're back in the underbrush and, you know, they just hang out there. They want to be basically left alone. Since Operation Rio Grande, that's no longer the case. So they're constantly on the move. So it's a challenge to go and find them and give them the syringes and, you know, give them information. They do a risk assessment on them.
Right.
They take their name and, you know, they try to keep track of these people over time.
You wrote that syringe exchanges are not without controversy here in Utah. House Speaker Greg Hughes even came up with a kind of nickname for the packs that the organizations like Resix are handing out.
Yeah, I called them party packs.
Right. Okay.
We all know for the last 4 years there's been a concerted effort here in the city and county to try to do something about the homeless population. And so a lot of times when we think homeless population, we think of drug addicts, but not all homeless people are drug addicts. But so that has been very slow to come together, and it's still in the formative stages. But at some point a couple of months ago, Greg Hughes, the Speaker of the House, just said, "I can't stand this. We're not doing this. We're wiping this thing out. And here we go." And he would walk down there and see heroin addicts everywhere, strewn on the sidewalk. And it's really a hard sight to take in. It's third world or beyond. And then he saw the syringe exchange. And so his notion was, oh, my God. What we're doing is we're helping these people be addicts.
He thinks it was encouraging drug use, the person that you spoke with and went out with looks at it as preventing disease and serving, again, as that sort of bridge to people who are seeking help. Part of this has to do with the fact that there's a stigma to addiction, and you know, addiction itself is obviously a terrible thing, but there's a pretty big divide over how to handle it from the policy side. Do you treat people as though they have an illness called addiction, which is what health officials seem to tend to favor, or Or is, you know, drug addiction criminal behavior that requires kind of the tough love approach or whatever you want to call it? Shorthand, but is that a fair description of the divide on the policy side,
Yeah,
Chris?
So, you know, when in times past, decades past, heroin users were thought of as these, you know, creatures, you know, from the sewer, and they were the worst of the worst. But what we're seeing today with the opioid epidemic, and it's growing every day, we have more addicts, a lot more. And that sort of eventually trickles into these folks taking up heroin. And so now you've got, like, for example, I interviewed a 60-year-old grandmother heroin addict who was camping out on 500 West. Mm. I interviewed a 17-year-old who should have been in high school, girl, female, young lady, whatever you want to call it. She was on heroin. So, and everybody in between. So we have it's really a serious problem. And locking them up doesn't do any good.
George Pyle, I believe the Tribune weighed in with an editorial on syringe exchanges. What did that editorial say? And then what do you think about the program that Chris reported on?
Yeah, no, I think we've weighed in on it a couple of times recently, and we're very much in favor of the syringe exchange programs. We're very much on the side that wants to approach this as a public health matter and not militarize it, even though it's perfectly understandable that somebody would look at the situation over by Rio Grande and say, you know, it's time for Operation Shock and Awe. We need to do something. We need to break this up. But then, as with other invasions, the question is, well, now what do you do? How do you hold the territory? How do you rebuild
the sort of hearts and minds
Baghdad.
Work, right?
Yeah. Yes. How do you rebuild Baghdad? How do you rebuild Rio Grande? Hmm. And who's responsible for this? And do you have to understand the culture? Do you have to get down there on the ground and talk to people and learn the mores of the culture and learn the chain of command that maybe has sort of evolved there over time? Or do you just drop a bomb on it and call it good? And there's always the subtext, especially with the Rio Grande neighborhood, that it's the next downtown, and it's being looked at by developers right. as the next place to turn a profit and get a commission. And so my analogy has always been that it's like you send the Indians off to this horrible patch of ground that nobody wants, and then you realize it has gold or oil or something, and you got to chase the Indians off because now the land is valuable to you, mm-hmm. and you don't care about them at all. And so you have a conflict now between the people who want to militarize this and treat it as a war, as interdiction, which never works, and those who want to treat it as a public health problem and as a disease, which does work but takes a long time.
Well, again, some really interesting stories from people who are taking advantage of this syringe exchange program. Just quickly, Chris, how is the program being funded?
So this was just a year ago that this became legal in Utah. So these syringe programs get various grants, mostly through federal money coming this way and that way, but they've just begun to get funded. Okay. So this is just a brand new thing, and the folks who are doing it are not doing it for money.
Right.
It's really a cause for them because these people have been through it,
yep.
and they know what it is, and it's tough.
Wow. Well, again, stories from the people who are suffering from addiction, many of them homeless people, can be found in Chris's article at the Tribune's website or in the physical newspaper. Guys, it's time for another quick break, but when we come back, we'll turn to the declaration of a public health emergency. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back in a moment.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines. Tom Williams, UPR Program Director here. Just a quick note, additional information for you, adding to the discussion that the Behind the Headlines was having a little earlier in the program about Classical 89, KBYU dropping their classical music coming up next year. We want to make you aware, if you aren't aware, that Utah Public Radio has an additional stream, RHD2, if you have an HD radio, is all classical all the time. And in certain areas of the state, you can pick that up if you have an HD radio. You can also pick that up anywhere you are, online, upr.org, upr.org, upper right-hand corner, listen live. You have options for UPR Live or UPR2. UPR2 is all classical all the time.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Chris Smart, Scott Pierce, George Pyle. You can join us by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And actually, we're going to add one more reporter to the mix. Thomas Burr, Tribune Washington Bureau Chief, joins us on the phone. Good morning, Tommy.
Hey, good morning.
And Tommy, I'm sorry to say we don't have a lot of time left in the show, but you reported on something that's happening there in Washington. There are some Utah fingerprints on, or at least there was some Utah support yesterday for the declaration by President Donald Trump of a public health emergency. And for those who may have missed the news, what's the emergency and what do Utah elected officials have to say about it?
Sure. So this is about the opioid crisis. In Utah, there are six Utahns who die every week from opioid overdoses. And we're the seventh highest in the nation for drug overdoses, the seventh highest. Which is pretty scary. So yesterday, Trump declared this to be a national public health emergency, which essentially doesn't free up any more money. It kind of can move some money around to help local communities and states fight the crisis. But mainly it's to raise attention to the issue. And Utah's Attorney General Sean Reyes was in the East Room for the announcement. And there's others who I talked to somebody at the public health department in Utah yesterday about how this might help Utah. And essentially they're just hoping that this, you know, brings attention, that the public's more aware of it, and then maybe, you know, puts doctors on notice a little more about prescribing opioids. It puts people on notice maybe they shouldn't be asking for them, and then maybe something else can be done about it. But it is got to the point where, you know, thousands of people are dying every year from this one crisis, and I think the total was like 200,000 have died so far.
Hmm. You talked about the sort of increasing visibility or increasing awareness. Is there money involved to go to states to try to work on this, you know, this massive problem?
So not right now. Essentially, what Trump did was it frees up some money that may have been going to, you know, syringe exchanges or HIV crisis. So it kind of take that money is now available to fight the opioids. But really, they're going to have to go to Congress again and ask for it to be part of, you know, some kind of new funding mechanism to actually get any more direct funding to states.
And you said that, again, this is more than just kind of optics here in Utah, because we have, you said, the seventh highest rate of opioid overdose in the country?
Yeah, drug overdoses in the country. And then, again, six Utahns die every week. So almost one a day is dying from this crisis. And let's remember, this is not just opioids, because it's been shown in Utah, for example, there was actually a decrease in opioid use in 2015, but an increase in heroin use. And the idea, the thought is that people who use opioids then turn to heroin to, you know, keep getting a higher fix.
Hmm. You know, I'm actually going to turn just for a second here to George Pyle, editorial voice again on the program. And George, just an American epidemic and now a national health emergency declaration. You know, everything is needed, I guess, here.
Yeah, and this is one of those things that I think, in a way, kind of snuck up on us, because opioids don't come from the troll under the bridge. They come from your doctor, and the doctor gets it from big pharma, where they have nice, big, clean factories that have pressure washers and stainless steel and people in hazmat suits not to contaminate the medicine. So it must be safe. And so it's kind of taken us a while to realize that it's being overprescribed. It's people are going around to different doctors, or you're finding doctors who just hand this stuff out like it's jelly beans. And there's a lot of research being done now, a lot of journalistic research being done right now, to uncover the fact that a lot of this stuff was sold to the medical profession, to doctors, under false pretenses. They almost like, you know, you used to have doctors do ads for cigarettes, and you have people going around saying, no, we've licked the problem. We've formulated this in a way that it's not addictive. So you can give it to anybody who's got a toothache or wrenched their back or something, and they'll be fine. And we're finding out that that is not the case. And we are finding out that this misinformation, again, was not spread by, you know, drug cartels from Colombia. It was spread by large corporations and doctors in good standing who were telling us things that weren't true.
Well, and the question, I guess, this, you know, comes back, if you make the same parallel with cigarettes, it comes back to when people inside the industry knew that it was addictive and still, you know, kept selling it.
Yeah, there's been some really strong reporting on that, and there's going to be a lot more. And there's some real indication that there's a reckoning to come. And they told us cigarettes weren't addictive. They told us lead in the gasoline wasn't bad for us. They told us that opioids weren't addictive. Hmm. Well, they are.
Just to jump in there real fast.
Sure, Tommy.
Utah is one of several states that are investigating this. The attorney general is looking into, you know, how much did, you know, Big Pharma know about this? And in some ways, it's almost like completely blind ignorance if they didn't. If you look at, there was one town in West Virginia with, you know, a couple hundred residents, and there were like 9 million pills of opioids sold there.
Right.
I mean, that's clearly, there's something wrong.
Well, Tommy, we talked about this a little bit last week, but there was a bill that Senator Orrin Hatch was a sponsor of that weakened the DEA's ability to go after those, you know, suspicious sales, say, you know, of a massive amount of opioids going to a specific county. The senator's response was that wasn't the intent, and that it was addressing other problems in the code related to, I guess, Big Pharma.
Yeah, and the senator points out correctly that the bill passed through both chambers of Congress without a single vote of opposition. President Obama was the one who signed it into law. The DEA at the time didn't raise any concerns, but it has been, the 60 Minutes of Washington Post looked into this and said that it really hampered the DEA's ability to stop those large shipments. That was not addressed yesterday, of course, in the right. National Public Health Declaration, but we'll see if Congress may take it up.
Well, and I mean, donations going to congresspeople from Big Pharma, that's not an unheard of proposition either.
Yeah, they have a lot of sway in Washington.
Okay. Well, guys, you know what? We're going to have to turn, I think, to our underplayed stories of the week. We are at the end of the show, and so, Tommy, just thanks very much for your reporting on that story. But actually, let's stick with you, Tommy. What's your pick for underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, sure, no problem. So it's been, 26 days since the massacre in Las Vegas, where 58 people were shot from the country music concert.
Right.
And there was a lot of reporting in the days after that about the idea of banning these so-called bump stocks, which change semi-automatic rifles into essentially automatic rifles. We had a poll in the Salt Lake Tribune, Hinckley Institute, that showed, you know, a good majority of Utahns supported getting rid of those and banning them. Once again, 26 days out, it looks like that kind of effort has stalled. There's no movement on any legislation in Congress. It's not on anyone's agenda. It just kind of fell off, which is typically the pattern that happens when these tragedies occur.
Right, right. There's a big focus on it, and then it fades from view. Interesting pick, Thomas Spurr, for your pick there. Let's go to Scott Pierce. You have a pick for underplayed story?
Well, I hear there's some talk about this guy. I think his name is Harvey Weinstein. And certainly I don't think that has been underplayed, but I do think that what we have heard so far is the tip of the iceberg, not just in the entertainment industry, because I think there's a lot more to come from the entertainment industry, but the reason we're hearing that first is because famous actresses are making the allegations. I think that this is a story that is going to expand exponentially, and, you know, we've reached into ABC and NBC News, but it's going to go beyond the media. This is a story that we're going to be hearing about forever.
Everywhere, kind of endemic. Christopher Smart, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
This is not a sexual harassment story, but it is a sexual discrimination story. As we've been reporting for the last year and a half, the first female fire battalion chief in Salt Lake City, Martha Ellis, was sort of forced out after she was trying to hold the fire department to codes. You know, she was demoted. She appealed that and won her appeal. But the city is continuing to sort of drag its feet and this will come out very painfully and slowly, but this came to fore as Jackie Biskupski took office. And Jackie Biskupski turned a blind eye to this. So that's going to be, you know, dribbling out here.
Okay. Interesting pick there from Chris Smart. And George Pyle, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
I'm going to go totally silly on you. My favorite story, whether it was underplayed, is the story we had the other day about some poor woman who was discovered on a hiking trail up in Summit County.
Right.
They surmise, based on some surrounding evidence, that she was attacked by a moose. Apparently, she's okay. She went to the hospital. She went home. We don't even know her name.
Right.
The Department of Wildlife Resources would like to talk to her. Now, of course, the Venn diagram of Tribune readers and Monty Python fans instantly went to the opening titles of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, in which the subtitles went on about a moose bit my sister once.
Yes.
Mind you, moose bites can be really nasty. She was carving her initials in the side of the moose with a toothbrush given to her by her brother. And so that's where some of minds go. I've got the opening titles on the Tribune website on my entry.
It is
under my column.
Yeah.
So if you just want to laugh at, with all this bad news we've been talking about all day, if you just want to snort, that's a good thing to look at.
Yeah, or check out the opening sequence to Monty Python and the Holy Grail. For my part, I'm going to go with some news from last week, which is that the Twilight concert series is taking a break next year while Salt Lake City officials decide what to do with those popular summer concerts. Some of the proposals include shrinking it, moving it back to the Gallivan Center, putting it in a number of different venues, but it just changes the dynamic for next summer, and it'll be interesting to see what happens when and if the Twilight concerts return. Thomas Burr, Scott Pierce, Christopher Smart, and George Pyle, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining me this morning.
Aloha.
Thank you.
Aloha. That's it for this edition of the show. Thanks to KCPW's Jesse Ellis in Logan. The broadcast is managed by Tom Williams, Spencer Hulsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen. And thanks, as always, to the show's producer, Emily Means. You can find podcasts of this program and all of our local shows at kcpw.org. And while you're there, we're still working on our fall fundraising goal. Please consider making a pledge of support to support this and all of the programs that you hear. I'm Roger McDonough. You've been listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Have a great day and a wonderful weekend.
Tom Williams here once again, program director for UPR. Another note, prominent subject in this week's Behind the Headlines, of course, the news which broke this week that Classical 89 KBYU out of Brigham Young University is dropping their classical service as of next year. And we want to alert you to the fact that UPR has extensive classical music offerings. In the evenings on our regular over-the-air broadcast signal, you can pick up a performance today with Fred Child beginning at 9 o'clock, and then at 11 overnight, it's Beethoven Satellite Network. And it's classical all the time on our HD2 service. You can pick that up if you have an HD radio or online at upr.org. HD2, all classical, all the time. Thanks for listening.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Devour Utah, a bi-monthly magazine devoted to covering Utah's dining and drink scene with a spotlight on cooking, local happenings, and libations. Available at newsstands or online at devourutah.com.
Americans are more polarized than at any other time since the Civil War.
The levels of political division we see in the country are profoundly destabilizing to our government, to our economy, to our culture. And it's just all this hate and bitterness that circulates in our country, and it could get worse.
So how do we fix it? Find out next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Join us Sunday afternoon at 2 on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR, Logan, KUSK, Vernal, KUSL, Richfield, KUST, Moab, KCEU, Price, KUSU, FM, Logan. Also heard at upr.org.